It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Unidentified gunmen hit a Kenyan coastal town. 2 months and still no end to the abduction of those Nigerian schoolgirls. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Unidentified gunmen opened fire Sunday in a popular Indian Ocean coastal town in Kenya in an attack that witnesses say went on for hours. There are varying reports of casualties in Mpeketoni, which came after bars and cafes were packed with fans watching World Cup activity. At least 2 hotels were set afire. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility, but an army spokesman blamed al-Shabaab militants from neighboring Somalia. In Nigeria, 4 visiting U.S. lawmakers Sunday called for a special fund for victims of the Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria that has claimed thousands of lives and the abduction of more than 200 schoolgirls. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee is the ranking Democratic member of the House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee.
Today we call upon the government of Nigeria to establish a national victims fund for all of the victims who have suffered at the hands of Boko Haram, for the girls who are still missing, for the girls who escaped, for their families, for the father who came and spoke to us about his missing daughter, and he could hardly speak, for tears were coming into his eyes.
The delegation was in Nigeria as part of a global effort to keep attention focused on those missing schoolgirls abducted April 14th from a school in northeast Borno State. Heather Murdoch has more on this story.
University of Abuja Criminology and Social Sciences professor Femi Odikunle agrees with some analysts who say the girls will never be freed unless the government agrees to swap them for prisoners.
I believe that the government should go out of his way to make deals with the Boko Haram people or their representatives to get the girls released. Because after all, if the girls are released, you could still go ahead and pursue. But militarily, if you try to attack them, you are likely to kill, to get the girls killed.
If the girls are rescued or released, analysts say they are likely to go home traumatized, potentially victims of sexual violence. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
In Libya, troops loyal to a former general who has vowed to wage war against Islamist groups in the North African country launched airstrikes Sunday against suspected Islamist militia in the second largest city, Benghazi. The strikes followed a ground assault a day earlier that reportedly left at least 5 dead. Authorities are trying to reestablish order ahead of a June 25 parliamentary election. The retired general Khalifa Haftar spoke Sunday with journalists. He says, on election day, we are eager to ensure that everything goes well, and accordingly, they, the other side, has requested a ceasefire. He said his forces are decreasing the intensity of their operations in order to give elections a chance. The former general also praised Egypt's new president, former army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, and his crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, which he described as an international spy network. In Egypt, a court Sunday reportedly jailed 3 people for life and 2 to 7 years in prison for creating a terror group and killing 4 Coptic Christians in 2010 during an attack in an eastern suburb of Cairo. Ivorian fans were joyful at their World Cup team's victory, coming from behind to defeat Japan 2-1 Saturday in Brazil. Computer engineer Alain Abadou in Abidjan said he was concerned, especially as Ivory Coast did not equalize before the break. He said, Japan has a good team who scored first, but our experience, he says, pulled us through. Meanwhile, Ghana's captain Osomoya Gyan said he believes his team will prove successful with their opponent, the United States, when the two sides clash in Brazil later today in a Group G match.
I think so. Ghana is the most talented team. You know, we've got young, talented players, you know, who are coming up. You know, talking about the tournament, I think we've got the youngest team. And most of the players are playing well in their clubs. You know, they are in great shape.
The Black Stars defeated the Americans in the past 2 World Cups, including a knockout victory in South Africa 4 years ago. Meanwhile, Nigeria takes on Iran later today. Aid agencies have warned Sunday that starvation and diseases like malaria and cholera are set to intensify in South Sudan. Emma Jane Drew of Oxfam says the conflict has taken thousands of lives and destroyed the livelihood of millions. She says the people of South Sudan have been exposed to a triple threat: conflict, hunger, and disease. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan frees a jailed opposition leader, and his party says talk of political dialogue is a joke.
There can be no dialogue when you are under the threat of the barrel. When you say anything different, you will be criminalized. The media, if they talk about the lack of freedom, they are criminalized.
Mariam Al-Sadiq Al-Mahdi is the daughter of Sudan opposition leader Sadiq Al-Mahdi. Nigeria's government calls on opposition parties not to politicize Boko Haram violence. And Uganda debates a minimum wage law, and the DRC government says FDLR rebels are disarming.
This followed very tense military tension and a call from the head of state, President Joseph Kabila, who offered them to disarm voluntarily so that they can avoid this military pressure.
Lamba Mende is the Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister, and South Africa's mentally ill have a tough time on the streets. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Sudan, the daughter of opposition leader Sadiq al-Mahdi says there can be no national political dialogue when everything the people say is criminalized and also when there is a lack of press and religious freedom. Mariam al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, who is also the first woman vice president of the opposition National Umar Party, says the arrest and sentencing by hanging of Mariam Yahya Ibrahim Isha for apostasy is nonsensical because one of the basic tenets of Islam is freedom of thought and belief. She made the remarks after Sudanese authorities Sunday released her father, who was arrested in mid-May after he was accused of undermining the constitution. Mariam al-Mahdi tells me her father's arrest and detention was a political conspiracy by the government of President Omar al-Bashir.
He was released after 30 years of detention. Of course, it was absolutely political conspiracy by the regime, because according to our party, after we studied all the reports from different grassroots in different parts of Sudan, we called upon the government in a press conference to conduct an investigation of the atrocities alleged by the support force. So they accused him of undermining the constitution. Of course, the whole detention matter was totally outside the jurisdiction of law, because in Sudan law, any man or woman 70 years of age and above, they do not have detention nor the death penalty, even if found guilty.
I did talk with the information minister of Sudan, Ahmed Bilal. I asked him about your father. Why was he detained? And he said, well, he violated the law, and that's why he was arrested.
The law was not at all broken by him. We decided in public to demand an investigation about the rapid security forces, which are forces the security institution of Sudan, which is absolutely unconstitutional. In our constitution, any army, the old armed force is only the Sudanese armed forces. This or the security are assigned by our constitution to collect information and to analyze it and to give advice. They don't even have allowance to make any arrest or to interrogate people.
President Omar al-Bashir, his government has been talking about national dialogue and political freedom. Every time we talk with the Minister of Information, he says the government is promoting national dialogue and there's freedom. Political parties are free to have meetings wherever they want to. Is your party going to take part in the national dialogue?
You see, there can be no dialogue when you are under the threat of the barrel. When you say anything different, you will be criminalized. The media, if they talk about the lack of freedom, they are criminalized. If they talk about corruption, they are criminalized. So in this atmosphere, there cannot be any dialogue. It is only a place for a monologue.
Before I let you go, Mariam, let me ask you, what is your own view on the detention of this woman who is in jail for her religious views.
This is absolutely nonsensical verdict, because the basic and essence of Islam is freedom of religion and hope. And there is no place for criminalizing a person for their own thoughts.
Mariam Al-Sadiq Al-Mahdi is the daughter of Sudan opposition leader Sadiq Al-Mahdi. He was released on Sunday from prison. She was speaking with me from Khartoum. The Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister says hundreds of rebels from the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, known as the FDLR, from South and North Kivu provinces have been disarmed as part of the government's program to improve security and stabilize the country. Lambert Mendes says the government in Kinshasa is working with its partners to help the disarmed rebels repatriate to Rwanda. He tells reporter Peter Clotty that about 15% of the FDLR rebels are in DRC government camps after they voluntarily disarmed.
Well, let me tell you that these followed very tense military pressure our army made on them, and a call from the head of state, President Joseph Kabila, who offered them to disarm voluntarily so that they can avoid these military pressure. So they responded very quickly to offer a voluntary disarmament. And we agreed on it. We discussed with our partners of MONUSCO and of SADC, who are helping us to receive them, accommodate them, transport them, and organize meetings with Rwanda and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to have them back home.
So are these members of the FDLR from Rwanda that is being accused of perpetrating genocide in Rwanda? Are there other armed groups part of this disarmament program?
This is concerning FDLR. Some of them are genocidaires, really, but others are not, because I visited the camp, the MONUSCO set up in Kanyabayonga, 200 kilometers from Goma. Myself, I went there, and I witnessed that a majority of them have less than 20 years, you know, that the genocide occurred 20 years ago. And, you know, these young men of 15 years, 16, 17, you can't call them genocidaires. Maybe they are parents, they are fathers. And there is a lot of Congolese women who are linked with them, fiancé or wives. And we have to care about these compatriots, know if they are willing to follow their men when they are back to Rwanda, or if they want to remain in Congo depending on their own will. That is why we are making now assessment on each case.
So in your estimation, how many have disbanded, and when is the president ultimatum going to elapse?
They have only one command. Those in North Kivu and those in South Kivu, they respond to one command. That is why we have a group already in North Kivu who gave back the guns, and another group in South Kivu, and we are following a timetable we have discussed with them. So we are waiting about 1,300 to 1,500. This is the number for the FDLR remaining in our country.
Lambert Mende is the Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kinshasa. It is Monday morning, June 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Nigeria's Minister of Information, Labaran Maku, has called on the Opposition Action Congress Party, the APC, to stop playing politics with Boko Haram and its terrorist activities. Instead, he says the opposition should find ways to cooperate with the federal government and the governors in APC-controlled states where Boko Haram is most active to defeat terror. at its convention last Friday in preparation for the 2015 presidential election. Former APC interim chairman B.C. Akande reportedly said the inability of the Goodluck Jonathan government to end the Boko Haram violence has made Nigeria, quote, a subject of some form of global assistance. Information Minister Maku tells me that politicizing Boko Haram is not in the interest of the country.
First of all, at the level of the federal government of Nigeria, we have tried to unite the country so that we do not play politics with the issue of terrorism. And because wherever terror strikes, it's important that all political leaders and the citizens unite behind the leadership and security forces for that success to happen. So as a government, we have tried to educate all the political parties, including the ruling party, that we should work together. We should avoid partisan politics as far as possible when we're dealing with the issue of terror. But unfortunately, some of our political leaders continue to try to see if they can use these terror attacks as a tool to win the next election, which indeed is very, very unfortunate.
Mr. Minister, there's a delegation of U.S. members of Congress headed by, I think, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson. They're in Nigeria, as I said, to drum up support for the rescue of the teenage girls who were kidnapped on April 14. Has your government had a chance to meet these members of Congress?
I wouldn't know, because if they actually booked to see the president or not, because I wouldn't know. Nigeria is a vast country, but we as an entire nation have always welcomed the cooperation of the United States government and its people involved in the fight against terror, which is indeed an international war. But terror is an international network of people that are operating in several countries, and America has been in this fight over the last 10 years in several countries. So the truth is, U.S. has been an important ally, and so we welcome the opinion of several American politicians and individuals.
Mr. Minister, bring us up to date, because where is your government now in the hunt, in the search for these girls?
We've been on it consistently, without let, working through security forces to try to see that those girls are rescued. Like I said, the entire nation is focused on the rescue of those girls.
You said that you don't like for the opposition to play politics with the plight of the kidnapped girls. The election is coming up in 2015, yet it's not clear whether President Goodluck Jonathan is going to run.
Yeah, but like I said, to the president, it's entitled to run because he has just spent one time in power. And this time has been very, very successful as far as domestic developments of Nigeria are concerned. You want to judge the president from the operation of terrorists in parts of the country, mainly controlled by APC states, because we know the origin and the emergence of those terror groups. And we are hoping that APC will try to do its best to avoid that line, because they won't come out of the field, because we know very clearly that they have a domestic responsibility to make sure that their own states, the state and local governments that operate in the APC control states where terrorists are actually in them, do much more in dealing with the situation.
Laberi Maku is Nigeria's Minister of Information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Labor activists are criticizing Uganda for failing to establish a minimum wage. The government's labor minister says the country will have one by next year. But within Uganda, the move is controversial, with many saying that the focus should be on attracting investment and creating jobs. Hilary Hewler has more for VOA from Kampala.
Upon arriving in Geneva, Uganda's delegates to this year's International Labour Organization conference found themselves under attack. Despite decades of debate, Uganda has yet to fix a minimum wage, the ILO pointed out, and the organization demanded the government establish one by next year. Oloka Mesilamu represents the construction industry in Uganda's National Organization of Trade Unions. He says a minimum wage is crucial to prevent rampant exploitation.
What is happening is that in absence of minimum wage, these workers who are not skilled are exploited more, because given the unemployment rate in this country, employers pay anything. And these workers, because they are desperate, they take anything they are offered.
He argues a minimum wage would make Ugandan workers more productive.
These things have a direct bearing to the performance, the productivity. When workers are poorly paid, they don't perform. So it is important for the economy as well.
The Ugandan government has long been reluctant to fix the minimum wage. This time, the proposed wage for unskilled workers is 75,000 shillings, or around $30 a month. The country's labor minister has agreed to consider it, but only after studying the matter carefully. Pius Bigirimana of the Ministry of Gender, Labor and Social Development warns that acting too hastily could be bad for everyone.
You don't just rush into a minimum wage without studying to look at the employment trends, to look at the cost of living and the wage trends by profession, by geographical regions. So fixing a minimum wage without regard to all these factors may destabilize our macroeconomic framework and affect employment trends.
Sarah Sewanyana of the Kampala-based Economic Policy Research Center says most proponents of the minimum wage don't truly understand the Ugandan economy, where most jobs are informal and do not pay regular wages. Enacting a minimum wage could cut into formal employment even further, she says, or force employers to find other ways to recoup their costs.
Some of the benefits can be withdrawn, or this guy is going to reduce on the number of people that he's employing and make sure that he overworks this person whom you have already dictated that he has to get the 75,000.
While countries like Kenya and Nigeria do have minimum wages, their private sectors are also better developed than Uganda's, says Sewanyana. Here, the focus should be on employment, she says, even if it is badly paid. Uganda's labor minister has promised to enact a minimum wage by July 2015. In the meantime, says Mesilamu, the labor unions are pushing hard to ensure that such promises are kept. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
While there has been substantial research into homelessness in South Africa, the issue of homeless persons with mental illness has received little attention from researchers, services providers, policymakers, and local authorities. As Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg, very little is known about this group of people living on the fringes of society.
Snow-capped hills and sub-zero temperatures signal that winter has arrived in South Africa. For the homeless in Hillbrow, an inner-city residential neighbourhood in Johannesburg, survival in the harsh winter temperatures is tough. Sibizuzu Fuluni is homeless and says he's been living on the streets for many years.
Yes, a lot of people die here on the street.
When it's closed there on the shop, you just make the blanket to sleep there, others there by the shop ride. Our blanket to put on the train. I can show you our blanket.
In the middle of a bustling street in Hillbrow, Fuluni lifts a heavy metal drain cover to reveal a grubby pile of blankets and clothes wrapped in a tight ball. There is a vast amount of research about South Africa's homeless, but very little is known about homeless people suffering from mental illness. New research by Unotida Moyo from the University of Johannesburg, in conjunction with the Centre for Social Development in Africa, shed some light on the group of people living on Johannesburg streets. Moyo was motivated to pursue research into homelessness and mental health when her mentally ill brother went missing and nearly ended up on the streets.
So I discovered that I think there is a need for families, departments, different departments to really assist these people so that they don't land on the street without any help. Because you can see even their health is compromised.
Moyo says that mental illness can increase the risk of homelessness, while the harsh conditions on the street are likely to produce and aggravate symptoms of mental health. The nature of mental illness, she says, makes it difficult for homeless people to negotiate street life and meet their needs for food, safety, shelter and treatment. The homeless are particularly vulnerable to violence in Johannesburg. Police brutality is a common complaint on the streets of Hillbrow and became particularly problematic when South Africa hosted the World Cup in 2010. Progressive social policies and legislation such as the Bill of Rights of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa and the Mental Health Care Act of 2002 do have provisions for people with mental health issues. However, Moyo found that the rights of many homeless people with mental illness are violated because services for them often lag behind policy and legislation. During her interviews, homeless people complained of hostility from some health professionals and of having to wait longer than other patients at clinics and hospitals. Lillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Argentina edged Bosnia-Herzegovina 2-1 in Rio de Janeiro as France eclipsed Honduras 3-0 in Porto Alegre, and Switzerland edged Ecuador 2-1 in the capital Brasilia on Sunday. Earlier on Saturday, Ivory Coast pipped Japan 2-1, Costa Rica beat Uruguay 3-1, Italy edged England 2-1 as Colombia thrashed Greece 3-0. On Friday, Mexico pipped Cameroon 1-0, Netherlands humiliated defending champions Spain 5-1, and Chile dismissed Australia 3-1. Meanwhile, a wave of optimism is sweeping across Nigeria as African champions Nigeria Super Eagles tackle Iran in Curitiba today, Monday. Speaking to my colleague James Batty, Nigeria Minister of Information Labaran Maku explains why.
By the grace of God, we are expecting a victory over Iran in our first World Cup match in Brazil. First of all, well, Iran is a good footballing country, but you know, when it comes to football, I believe Nigeria has a better record. We've done better in football. We're the reigning African champion. We won the African Cup of Nations in 2013. We're the reigning champion. We won the Under-17 World Cup United Arab Emirates UAE last year, and we won by setting up a world record. We were never defeated. We had the highest goals scored by any nation in the Under-17 FIFA tournament. We have won the Olympic gold, as we did in Brazil, beating Brazil, Mexico, and Argentina in the runoff. Nigeria is a strong footballing nation, and in the end, Nigeria will not only make it in the first match, we are hoping that we'll go very far in this World Cup because we believe it's time for Africa to lift the cup.
I did read somewhere, Mr. Minister, where it says some Nigerians who normally would go out to sports bars to watch the World Cup are being intimidated or are afraid to go out because of fear that they might be attacked by the Boko Haram. What do you want to say to them?
What I'll tell Nigerians is that terror must not win. Terror is a temporary setback. And that, well, the terrorists, unfortunately, are very cowardly and they attack soft places. But all I say is we should be vigilant, even in the course of the World Cup, in places where there is a risk of attack, we need to be vigilant.
That was Labaran Maku, the Nigerian Minister of Information, speaking in Abuja, Nigeria. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, June 16th.
Dear Daybreak Africa and listeners across the world, permit me use your medium once again to call on President Goodluck Ebele Jonathan or the federal government of Nigeria to please be very careful over the pressure and demand from some quarter in Nigeria to grant amnesty to Boko Haram insurgents, the Islamic extremists who want to turn our beloved country, Nigeria, that will be living in peace and harmony to an Islamic state. Albert Alagbo, from Obutu Katu Ranch Virtual Ward, in Obaliko Local Government Area of Cross River State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Unidentified gunmen opened fire on a popular Indian Ocean coastal town in Kenya on Sunday in an attack that witnesses say went on for hours. That's it for this Monday, June 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strack, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jesse Brooks, I am James Butte in Washington, hoping that you make this week a very productive one. You want to listen to the latest African music? Dance to the best African beat from across the African continent? Then you don't have a problem. Just tune in to the African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays at exactly 0900 and 2000 Universal Time. African Beat, the show that brings happiness into your homes, smiles on your faces. So join me, your host, David Vandy, Monday through Friday, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time, on The Voice of America. Habaki Mondongo, Mwana Mbaliko, Habaki Mondongo.
Kimolongo.
African Beats
is the best. It's number one.
We love it.